Thank you, ladies, for that very excellent ministry and song. Thank you very much. All right. Well, I'm not going to give a long-winded introduction, but enough just to let you know that Dr. Robert McCabe is here to speak with us. He's a professor of Old Testament and Hebrew at Detroit Baptist Theological Seminary. I've taken a number of classes from him. I did not keep count of how many, but a number. And now, actually, the Lord has privileged me to take his place, if that is possible, to teach one of his Hebrew classes. And so I've been doing that this semester, as many of you know, and also next semester I'll be filling in. It's been a good experience for the teacher, at least. I don't know about the students, but they have to do all the work. But anyway, I've enjoyed that. I thank Dr. McCabe for that opportunity. But he has done this creation conference a number of times. And so I'm sure you will be well informed on these matters after these six sessions are done. And I've been looking forward to this for you folks for a long time. I've heard a number of these things already in various contexts. But we have the booklets up here, and I'd like to ask a couple of you gentlemen, maybe Ben and Andrew, if you could come and just help me distribute those very quickly. And then without any further ado, then I'll just ask Dr. McCabe to come up. While we're passing those out, he can do whatever introduction he has. And then you young folks can make your way to the back, and we'll head upstairs to the carpeted room up there, okay? All right, thank you very much. Dr. McCabe?
Well, it's a joy to be here tonight. I can honestly say that since I've had your pastor for, good night, I bet you 8-9 classes, I can honestly say you've got one of the smartest pastors around. So, in fact, I heard one of the students saying that they're going to take a poll and they're going to vote him in to be permanent Hebrew teacher and just retire me early. So he's doing well. Anyway, it is a privilege to be with you. I've been looking forward to this for a number of months now. What we have are some booklets. Pastor Post, if he took and reduced my notes to manageable form. He's a computer whiz, so he was able to do this pretty readily. I just wish I would have tapped into him a number of years ago with these. In fact, he probably could have written them too. So, in any event, he's done a lot of hard work in getting this ready, and I appreciate his effort. Appreciate you all being here, and hopefully, the Lord will bless our time. I would say this at the beginning. I'm not a scientist, nor the son of a scientist. About 10 years ago at our seminary, Dr. Combs, Dr. Compton, and I, we all studied together at the same time at Grace Theological Seminary when Dr. Wickham was there. And we noticed when we all were reunited to teach at Detroit about 20 years ago, one of the problems that we saw with some of our students is that they come from backgrounds where they really did understand that there was evolution before they were converted. And generally what happens when somebody gets converted, they become automatically a theistic evolutionist because now they believe in God and they think there was a big bang. Well, because of some of the issues that we saw developing, I had taken some classes from Dr. Wickham at Grace Seminary, and I had a little bit of the interest in studying what the Bible has to say. So I say all that to say I came at this because I wanted to understand what does the Bible teach. So my degrees are strictly theological and Hebrew. I do not have a PhD in science or physics, and quite frankly, I have no interest in science or physics except for what I need to know. So my expertise really is in the Bible stuff. And as it turns out, the Bible has a lot to say about creationism. We will have, I'm not sure how many pages of notes, I think it's about 60, but my seminary syllabus is about 120 to 150 pages. I'm not sure what the length is at this point. It's been evolving, and that's what's happened. So, of course, I put evolve in quotes there. But nevertheless, I will be able to try to attempt at least to answer your questions if you have them. I will give you what my understanding is of the Bible, and I'll try to give a rationale why I think the earth was recently created, I think 10 to 20,000 years ago, and why the Bible teaches that there are literal days in the creation week. What we have there is not heavenly days. We have earthly days. And I think the Bible is very clear on that, and I'll try to address some of those issues. So let's take our little booklets, and let's turn to page one. Let me just give you a brief introduction. The evolutionary model is in opposition to the Christian model. Notice with that, it's a strictly materialistic universe. There's natural origin of all things, chance, random mutation, natural selection. I'm still trying to figure out mathematically how that all fits together. But everything I've read, it's an impossibility. So we won't buy into that, but that's what the current worldview is. There's a net basic increase in complexity over time, so your distant relative is the cabbage you ate last week. Somehow you tie together in that great soup, but I'm not from that soup. Also, we have the early history dominated by uniform events. Probably today, more current is neocatastrophism. This will be the antithesis of what the biblical model is. So that's where we're headed here. The biblical creation model, it sets forth that there's a special creation. The triune God supernaturally created all things, including the direct creation of man, in six successive literal days. So our first plank is what we call special creation. The world was created perfectly. But how did we end up where we are? Well, that's where the fall comes in. God supernaturally placed a curse on all creation when Adam disobeyed God in Genesis 3. There's a real sense we can, in some sense, blame it on Adam. But I don't know that you or I would have done a better job, but nevertheless, biblically speaking, Adam and Eve sinned, and that plunged the human race, the world over which they rule, under the curse of sin. That's where the fall comes in. So the bad stuff comes from that. And then also, contrary to many evangelicals today, the flood was universal. There's good biblical reasons why it had to be a worldwide catastrophe. We will look at that. Myself, I think the vast majority of fossil records, not all, but I think the vast majority would come from the Noahic flood, the ramifications of that. And afterwards, when the ice age froze those things in time, we can see how this goes back to one major event, namely the universal flood. So we'll also look at that. So let me lay out the way this is. Tonight we're going to deal with what is the nature of special creation. Tomorrow night, is there a gap between Genesis 1 and 2? Your church is like our church. We're a dispensational church. The background for most dispensational churches is the Scofield Reference Bible, with the gap theory being taught there. We need to understand what our history is, though most people do not subscribe to the gap theory today. There's modifications of that, but that is the roots of our background. I know Grace Seminary, Dr. McLean held to the gap theory. In fact, it really wasn't until Dr. Wickham came along and he and Henry Morris wrote the book, The Genesis Flood, did that change the landscape of Grace Seminary. In fact, that's what put Winona Lake on the map. And you're saying, where's Winona Lake? It's in Indiana. You just go about 30 miles west of Fort Wayne, and you'll come to Warsaw-Winona Lake. Well, Wickham, when he wrote the book with Henry Morris, The Genesis Flood, it was published in 1961. That started something of a revolution in dispensational circles, where pretty much the gap theory is dying pretty quickly, but there's vestiges of that holding on. So we're gonna go through that, and when we go through that, I'll try to lay out a case why I think the gap theory cannot be right and what the Bible does actually teach on what happened there in Genesis 1. So that'll be our second message. That'll be tomorrow night. I'll move that a little bit because I'll have a tendency to look this way. Message 3 will focus on when and how did death become a part of God's created universe. Message 4 will look at what is the nature and result of Noah's flood. Message 5, why does God delight in a special creation? That'll be my Sunday morning message. God's got a special place in his heart, so to speak, for his perfect creation. And I think there's implications for why we will be redeemed and the created order will be restored into the pristine glory that was there prior to the fall. And so we'll want to understand why God does delight. Is he clear in his word on that? So that'll be Sunday morning. And then our last message is, what is the significance of creation, the fall, and the flood? The point of the last one will be tying it all together. We have to develop what I call a world and life view. My theology and philosophy of life predicts how I'm going to operate in a fallen world. Can I suggest to you that your understanding of some of those things related to the fall reflects how you may be watching TV and what you may not watch, maybe why you don't watch TV, how you operate on the internet? There's a lot of practical ramifications to this, and I think it ties into our world and life view. How do we integrate God's special creation with how we live? So that's what I'll try to do in the last message as the booklet reflects. So that's a little bit of the overview. What we'll do then is I will change my PowerPoint here. And we'll move to the nature of creation. This will be on page 2. And we'll be picking up with part 1, the nature of creation. Almost 40 years ago in 1959, 100 years after Charles Darwin first put forth his theory of evolution, Sir Julian Huxley said, "Darwin's theory is no longer a theory, but a fact." No serious scientist would deny the fact that evolution has occurred, just as he would not deny the fact that the Earth goes around the sun. It's the logical leap there, I'm not sure about. But there is no inconsistency with the Earth being heliocentric. To me, the fact is, the world we live in, whether it be on the news media, there is an evolutionary mindset. Every little thing that's supporting evolution is going to be put on the news. And when some scientists who are creationists and others have collaborated and this evidence is found to be bogus, it's never retracted on TV. Why is that? Well, they're convinced humanism, which is driven by the philosophy of evolution, that it's right. And as a result, it's just a matter of time until we get the evidence. So they don't feel that there has to be a retraction. And it is abominable, friends, because about every time another Martian rock comes along, that gets disproven. So those types of things we just need to be familiar with, and we have to offset that as we work with our family, our friends, and our loved ones, because we have a mission to evangelize and to edify people and help them grow in the faith and to help them be able to overcome the obstacles in our current world. Unfortunately, that is the view today. However, if this is so prevalent, why are some leading scientists and creationist societies so radically opposed to any form of evolution? In fact, can I say they're growing? Why is the Institute for Creation Research, why has that flourished, the Creation Research Society? Answers in Genesis is doing a booming business these days. Why is that? Well, friends, we think the Bible is pretty clear. We just live in a culture that does not want to hear it. Our problem is those who are evangelicals who want to take the in-betweenist view. Well, I call it the path of compromise. We want to harmonize science with the Bible. What I will say at the end of the day is that we do want to harmonize science and the Bible, but the question is, which is primary? Is it the Bible or is it science? I will argue, in fact, the nature of this will be that the Bible is primary. I think we should be doing research. I think Bible-believing people ought to be encouraging their children to get the advanced degrees to do that, inculcate the faith in them. But nevertheless, if all these things are right, there is a place for good scientific research, and we should want to see that. So to me, I think this all has a bearing on how we're going to operate in the long run of our lives and influence others. So to me, it does seem like we have a major job to do. Because the Bible is very clear, and almost all confessions of faith reflected that God created the heavens and the earth and all things therein. In the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Second London Baptist Confession, it says, in the space of 6 days, and all very good. Well, it sounds like these documents that go back to the 17th and 18th century, 17th, I guess that'd be the 18th century, that they really believed that God created the heavens and the earth in a literal 6 days. It sounds like in the space of 6 days means 6 successive consecutive days. And many confessions of faith, the Westminster Confession of Faith is the granddaddy of them all. They'll have statements to that effect. So why is it that those statements are so clear and the Christians who are theistic evolutionists or some form of that are trying to flaunt and promote their case to disprove what these confessions say? May I say, it's because I think they've compromised. The Bible was very clear, and that's what we'll try to set forth. So anyway, let's pick up here. I've got some pictures here. I get most of my pictures from Answers in Genesis. They've got pictures designed for people like me who have lectures and aren't very good with graphics. So I use their website all the time. But notice, this is a pictorial overview of the events of the creation week. Notice on day one, capital letter A, the first day, this is still, I guess it'll be at the bottom of page two and it'll spill over to page three. But notice A, the first day. God created the heavens with one localized light source. By the way, we picked that up in Genesis 1:3. God says, let there be light. So there is a light source, but notice the light source comes after the creation of the heavens. So Genesis 1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We need to understand by that, the heavens and the earth are incomplete. They're perfect for what God wanted at that point. So what would the heavens have been like? Darkness. And darkness covered the surface of the deep. Verse 2 of Genesis 1. So initially, you have the heavens, and you also have the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, verse 2 tells us what the earth is like. And the earth was unformed and unfilled, unformed and empty, unformed and void. That means that there's no biological life on earth. I will call it an abiotic form. There's inorganic stuff, but there's no organic stuff with the initial creation. So God then creates in verse 3, he says, Yehi or let there be light. The question comes down, what is that light? Well, some want to see it be the Shekinah glory of God, and that's a possibility. However, it's also possible that God had a temporary light source. It's an old Jewish view that goes back to, God doesn't specifically say. But the fact that he uses the creation, there's a formula in Genesis 1, it's called creation out of nothing. Creation ex nihilo. The same formula that's used for the other things that are creation ex nihilo are used for light. He says, Yehi or, let there be light. So it sounds like it's a created object rather than the Shekinah glory. But I can only give you an educated opinion on that. So it seems like there's a temporary light source. If you want to say it's a Shekinah glory, we're not going to spill any I'm not going to dump my coffee on you or anything like that. You can hold that. But it seems a little less likely. So that's day one. So really we've got space, we've got energy, we've got matter, we've got a mass. So that's what we have on day one. Then the second day is in Genesis 1 and verses 6 to 8. Let me back up here. I ran ahead of myself. Notice with the second day, we have God creating an expanse. It's some type of atmosphere that surrounds the earth. It divides the waters on the earth into an upper and lower level. Notice Genesis 1. It's hard to understand, at least for me, it's hard to understand what God's doing. But I think he's pretty clear here. Look at verse 8 of chapter 1. Then God said, let there be a firmament or an expanse. Firmament sometimes is misunderstood to think that there's something firm. It's probably better to take this with the NIV as being an expanse. Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. Notice, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament, or the expanse, and divided the waters which were under the firmament, under the expanse, from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven or sky, so there was evening and the morning, or the second day. So, whatever else we can see, the biblical text says there's water on the earth, and now there's water above the earth, with an expanse separating them. Now, many creationists will call this a water vapor canopy. To me, it seems like you've got to have something like that. there's some type of water above the earth. Now, how scientists want to work that out, is that a mixture of ice particles, just water as a vapor? I don't know that I can be specific on that, but I can say in this biblical view, the waters are above the earth. So what we need to be clear on at the outset here, there is a difference between what we call explicit propositional revelation. That is an explicit statement saying, thus saith the Lord. And what I'm saying here is that the text does not explicitly say that there's a vapor canopy. Now, the model of a vapor canopy is a model. We have certain details from Genesis, and based on what we think the biblical text explicitly states, we hypothesize a model. Notice that model is different than explicit truth. I think what's explicit, we need to be willing to die for. But the model, I can fight you on that. Those can be adapted. But we need to keep that in mind before, you know, we really start to interact with people, because there's some things we can just give on and it doesn't make much of a difference. But there are other things that we call explicit truth, what we call propositional revelation. Statements are made, truth claims are made. When we see that, that's what we tenaciously hold to. So I'm tenaciously holding that there's water above the earth. How scientists, I mean, I've listened to some lectures, and there's all kinds of modifications on the vapor canopy. Friends, I was going to say brethren, but you're women too. Friends, you can work out your own salvation with fear and trembling on that. Here, it is clear that it's a water, some type of water above the earth. So that's the second day. Now, the third day is where the dry land and the plants appear, verses 9 to 13. Notice then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields its seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in it, on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in it according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So there was evening, and the morning were the third day. Now, if you notice here, we've got three things going on. We got some type of continental structure form. Was there seven continents? Was there one continent? Well, we can see there was at least one continent, because the dry land appears. And it's surrounded by water. So we know there's at least one continent. Maybe there was two. But for sure, we do see that there was at least one continent. In fact, with plate tectonics and stuff, it seems to point as if there was some type of divide, and there may have been just one landmass initially. That's what the text would seem to say, that there's at least one continent. So we've got dry land, and also we have here the seas being formed. So we still have, at this point, inorganic stuff. We've got dry land, we've got seas. Notice we do have some organic life, though, in verse 3. Or, I'm sorry, on day 3. Did you notice what the text says? It says, let the earth bring forth grass. So the earth, that continent, has instantaneously grass coming forth. And notice the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind. Notice furthermore, whose seed is in itself. So what do we have here? We have full-grown fruit trees, full-grown grass. I think the text is telling us that creation came mature. It had, can we call it a superficial appearance of age? I know some don't like to say superficial. It sounds like God's deceiving us. Well, friends, the fact that God spells it out, it's not deception. But when Adam's going to be created, he was a mature adult along with his wife who was taken from his side. How old were they? Well, on day six, Adam, whenever God created him on that day, he was a mature man. Notice he came full grown. Notice the fruit trees came full grown. And the seed is in the fruit. It's ready to reproduce. That's what we mean by a mature creation. Adam and Eve come equipped, full grown, to reproduce. So notice the creation is what we call mature. On day three, that's when we have the first organic life. Prior to that, I would say the creation was, can we say, abiotic? No biological life. At this point, it now has some biotic stuff. We have the fruit trees. We have the grass. And they're primed and ready for those seeds and that fruit to drop off and produce more fruit. So it's a mature creation. That's the third day. Now notice the fourth day. It's very important for us to see. In verse 14, God says, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to divide the day from the night. And let the lights be for signs and seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give," notice, "light on the earth." And it was so. The implication is that whatever these lights are, it had some bearing on earth. Notice this verse 15. "And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. Verse 16, I should say. "Then God made two great lights. The greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." Notice the sun, the moon, and at least some of the stars have a bearing on planet Earth. Now, some have taken this to say that the universe is geocentric, that everything revolves around the Earth. That was a common view back before Galileo. What most people don't understand is that this was not a Christian thing before that. This came from the Greeks. The Greeks did some good, they did some bad. They're just like people living in the United States. So notice, this is not demanding that the universe revolves around the earth. It does say that God's focus is on the earth, at least as far as his plan and his plan related to the earthly kingdom's concerned. The one thing we need to be clear on, though, is that the earth was created by the sun, just the opposite of the Big Bang. That one have the sun come first and then the earth. God, it's like he was anticipating our day to come. Y'all have it wrong. Y'all living in the 21st century, God probably was a southerner. The thee and the thou was good because you could see a singular and you was a plural. Down in the south, they just say y'all. So y'all would know that it's really the earth that was created first, not the sun. Now there was light, and we have a day-night cycle. So notice, perhaps the earth, in fact, I think the earth was rotating on its axis at that point. This temporary light source is used to divide the day from the night. On day four, he uses the sun to continue to advance his operations here, so that now is what's giving us light on the earth. That does not conflict with a heliocentric view. I mean, if I understand gravity, you know, we have a mass here on the earth, but we also have the sun. We keep in our orbit. Notice the evidence on that's very clear. The Bible never says that it's geocentric. Heliocentrism fits in with the statements of the Bible. So notice, we have here the sun, the moon, and the stars being created. So notice, these are in verse 18, to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it good. It was good. So the evening and morning were the fourth day. So what about the starlight? How did that, I mean, doesn't that take, light years to get here? Well, I think we need to remember, God was creating this, and there is a focus toward Earth. These have a bearing on our light, our day and night cycle. So I would understand here that the light travel was in transition. So, I'm not familiar with how the starlight works and things like this. Is this a straight line? Is there a curvature in this? Can we really say that this, the Earth is billions of years old because of that? Well, by the nature of science, it's inductive. Some things are very clear. The heliocentric nature of the Earth is very clear. The other things are not clear. I would say, friends, if God created the Earth with mature people, mature plants, mature animals, He could, in fact, I would say He did create it so that this light was in transition, so it does come to Earth immediately. So in the Bible, it seems to be very clear on this point. So that's the fourth day. Notice the fifth day. Here God created all sea creatures, including the great creatures and the birds that fly in the air, verses 20 to 23. Then God said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament," or the expanse of the heavens. So God created sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. Notice the creatures here created are created according to their kind. That is, these are the kind that can reproduce and have offspring, and they will have offspring. So are the kind a species? Absolutely not. The kind are a category. Let's just hypothesize here for a moment. It would seem like when God created animals, He created the forerunner to the cat and our current dog. They would have to have had the DNA, and they'd have to be able to reproduce. The biblical kind can be larger. Can a miniature schnauzer reproduce with St. Bernard? Well, there's size dimensions there, but potentially, you work everything out, they can have other little dogs. So what was the first dog? Well, it was probably Lassie and Laddie, the perfect dogs. But we need to understand that they had the genetic capabilities to have all the varieties that we have today. The same thing's true with people. We may have different complexions, but friends, if we can reproduce together, we're of the same kind. Now, that being the case, the same thing's true with the dog family, the cat family. And from whatever the proto-cat was, we have the tomcat, the leopard, and whatever else goes into the mix. They had to come with the genetic capabilities to reproduce after their kind. And so then you can have variations. By the way, how many generations do you have to have variations? Just a few. So it's not something that requires, millions of generations. You just need a few to have some variation. So we can see here with these sea creatures, the birds. These are full grown, and they're created according to their kind. The biblical kind is those that can reproduce. Because the point of a mature creation is to get things going. If you don't have reproduction, then you can't get it going. So which came first, the chicken or the egg? That's really a dumb question. It was the chicken, according to the account here. And it was capable of having little chicks with that rooster on the first day. So they are full grown. Notice we come to the ultimate And that's really day 6, verses 24 to 31. Notice God puts more time into day 6 verse-wise than the other days. That's because there is a sense that you are special. Now, I'm not throwing off the yoke of your depravity. So we don't want to be extreme that we're so special, we're no good. But nevertheless, friends, if your ancestors, the monkey, you're not that special. In God's book here, in Genesis 1, man and woman are the ultimate in the created order. And there's a reason why. Let's look at these verses. Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind. Notice we have cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kind. So you have the cattle, they're according to their kind, that's a generic category. You have creeps, creeping things, they're according to their kind. And the beasts of the earth, they're according to their kind. These are three broad categories. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So notice, we've got the cattle, we've got the creeping things, we've got the beast of the earth. Notice verse 26. Then God said, let us make man. Now notice, not after his kind, but in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Who's the king and queen here? Adam and Eve. Notice, they're created, and they have the capacity to rule over the creatures, over the critters. That's their kingdom. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seeds, to you it shall be for food. And also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life. I have given every green herb for food, and it was so. So what was their diet? Strictly vegetarian. Verse 31, then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Now I'm not sure what very good means to God, because when God says it's good, that's for us a superlative. But when he says it's very good, this is the capstone to all his creation. I can't comprehend that. But he's finished with his creation. Now, I spent some time going through that because we do need to see what is being laid out in Genesis 1. We call this the biblical theology. We need to see where our nuts and bolts are. And these are firmly planted in a created order that's created with maturity. So that's the nature of the creation. Now, this is quite a contrast with evolution, isn't it? With evolution, we have death, millions of years. But with creation, it starts good. But then it goes south in Genesis 3, where Adam, in disobedience to God, eats from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. By the way, who was the first sinner? Adam or Eve? Well, it was Eve. Remember, she ate first? Now, when did you and I get affected? Well, it wasn't when she ate. It's when Adam ate. God set up a relationship with Adam. He was in a period of probation. He had to successfully pass the test of not eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Unfortunately, for us, he failed. However, God, with this plan that includes the fall, is going to get greater glory in the end from that. Now, how that works out, I don't fully understand. I wish sin was all gone and we didn't have to deal with it. Now, I wish my sin was gone and I didn't have to deal with it. I really wish that my children would have been gone when they were in high school. But I could have exterminated them if I would have been thinking of it. But then if I missed, they would have exterminated me when I get old and I'm ready to be put into a nursing home. And they could just say, well, pull the tube when he stops breathing. And I may want that. I want to go to be with the Lord. But nevertheless, it does seem to me that the sin that we have here is a real part of life. So really, with the fall, it's downward. But afterwards, it will be upward. So there's quite a contrast between evolution and creation. Let's then look at the duration of creation. Now, since I will be giving this a lick and a promise tonight, my notes are fairly full. In the back of your booklet, I have a bibliography. It has key sources there. Let's just turn back there, and I'll recommend, well, you can see it's been marked to recommend sources. These are very good for you to read. You know, to me, on page 61, this book by Donald Chittick, The Controversy, The Roots of Creation, Evolution, Conflict, that's a very good book to explain what the basic issues are in the creation-evolution debate. Very good. Ken Ham's books, they're more popular. They're very easy reads. You can read them if you get sick on a Sunday afternoon and you're not in church. I read the lie one time when I was sick on a Sunday morning, a little bit of a Sunday afternoon. It's an easy read. Very good, though. A very good book is by John MacArthur, The Battle for the Beginning. That's dealing with Genesis 1 to 3, and it is a very helpful source. So I highly recommend that book for people in churches because he's written from a pastoral perspective and it's not real technical. Now, I did not recommend the article I wrote for our journal because it is technical. So if you ever want to fall asleep at night, this is a good one to read. It's better than Tylenol, nighttime, and all this stuff. I know I fell asleep many a night writing that. But that's not as readable. The ones by Sarfati and Wickham, they're very good. But I'd say on a popular level, MacArthur's probably got the best book, The Battle for the Beginning. So I would pick that up. So you can read through and study this, but what I want to do is I want to briefly argue why the days in Genesis 1 have to be literal. Now, I have a bunch of statistics here under point A, the semantics of the singular use of day. Notice here with this Hebrew word translated day, yom, it's always used of a literal day when it is used alone as a singular noun. Now, you say, well, can't we use day figuratively? Absolutely. In my grandfather's day, they had the Great Depression. In that context, it can be. It's all about the context. When the noun day is used singular, and I say it's alone, what I mean by that, there's not other grammatical obstructions to it. For example, they have what's called a genitive function. When that's put in like the day of my grandfather, that would be a genitive construction. The semantics of the word can be broader when you have that type of construction. So I'm specifying here, we're talking about a certain type of context where day is used. What is significant in our discussion is that when this is used and it's not part of a compound grammatical construction and it's a singular noun, it's always a literal day or a portion thereof. It's never used for a figure. Notice, can we have the evidence for this? Absolutely. There's 2,304 uses of it in the Bible. We have a very, very good picture of the word day. And so with this, in fact, really, somebody will say that there's some type of discussion, and occasionally this article I wrote appears on some web blog where they're interacting with it. And I've never had anybody be able to answer my claim. Day can be used figuratively when it's part of a compound grammatical construction. Give me an example when it's not part of a compound grammatical construction. Nobody's given me an answer yet.
So, now I did not come up with that by myself. Other real Hebrew scholars took that view, and I got it from them. Do you know where I got it? Hebrew lexicons. Hebrew dictionaries are written by people who are not born-again Christians. They're just looking at statistics and how words are used. I do not have one lexicon that says that the noun day, when it's used as a singular noun, and it is not part of a compound grammatical construction, it's always a literal day or a portion thereof. There's not one time. In fact, if you can come up with the lexicon, let me know, because I keep statistics on this, and I do change my creationism notes. I'm not the Pope, so I'm not infallible. That's why I like having your pastor in my classes. When he speaks, I usually listen, because he sees some little quirk that's out of line. But now he's never embarrassed me in class, so I can't say that. So, you know, to me, these things, it's clear cut. So we know that this is always singular when it's in this type of grammatical construction. Also, when you have a word day and it's qualified by evening and morning, doesn't that sound like a literal day? I mean, there's evening and there was morning. Sure it does. That qualifier also tells us that it's a literal day. Also, another reason why day must be a literal day is drawn from the use of the numerical adjective with the word. A numerical adjective, the first day, the second day. In every case when that's used in the Old Testament, that's always a singular day. Also, we have scriptural parallels with day. The one that just always floors me, I have cited in my notes here on page 7. I have the text actually quoted. The one that's the getter is Exodus 20, verse 11. This is with point D on page 7. This is the text you can use, friends. When somebody says, why do you believe in literal days? You're going to forget this stuff about semantics. But if you know the Ten Commandments, you can turn to this one. Remember this one about the Sabbath day? God gives a reason why the Sabbath day is supposed to be kept. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Notice that day was set apart because God ceased his creative activity. God didn't need to be rejuvenated. God was rejoicing over his creation because it was so perfect. And it reflected a created substance that reflected his glory. And he was excited. Notice another text you can use is Exodus 31:16. You can go to that. I do a little characterization here, but this is probably good for the effect. Let's go back to this Exodus 20, verse 11. Let's just change this to a geological age. So instead of 4 in 6 days, we have 4 in 6 geological ages of 1 million years or so. The Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh geological age of 1 million years or so. Wherefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath geological age of 1 million years or so and hallowed it. You know, we should not be at the time of rest now, if that's true. Friends, it obliterates the meaning of the text to think of it in terms of ages. Exodus 31:16 is another passage that has the same thing. Do you remember the man in I think it's in Numbers 15? He's picking up sticks on the Sabbath. He brings them before Moses, and Moses pulls out the Ten Commandments, and he says, you know, God gave us an absolute command here. You violated it. The congregation of Israel stoned him. That poor guy, he should have said, you know, Moses, you have it all wrong. Those were geological ages. Put those stones down. Yeah. God was thinking analogically. Let's get rid of the stones. Friends, with these two passages, everybody can say, look, this is what God's Word says. I don't need somebody who knows a little bit of Hebrew. I don't need my pastor who knows Hebrew. I've just got my Bible here. So you can do that. And I think you can do that, I'd say effectively, but I've had some people get mad at me and say, this is analogical. And I say, let's talk about this guy that got stoned in Numbers 15. And nobody says, well, you're just a crazy literalist. Well, usually at that point, they recognize they can't win the argument. So they're going to resort to some type of characterization, or they're somehow going to put you in a corner that you can't get out of. Well, I'm crazy enough with old age. I just take them back to Exodus 20. So this is a verse everybody can use. And there's one final thing here. The sequence of events in the days. When we think about the symbiotic relationships, you know, the birds and the bees and all that stuff, and you've got an extended age here, how did the plants survive? I can explain it with a recent creation. It's a matter of hours. They can't survive at that rate. But if it's ages, it just can't make it. So notice, everything points to an age. So if you get the point, day's clear. In fact, I've got a quote here from James Barr. He wrote a book called Fundamentalism, and he doesn't state it quite like this, but he says the same thing there. Now, James Barr is dead. He went on for his reward. He was a liberal, critical scholar. He's the type of guy who writes lexicons. And he says here, I think there's a little embellishment, but he says, as far as I know, there is no professor of Hebrew or Old Testament at any world-class university who does not believe that the writers of Genesis 1 through 11 intended to convey to the readers the idea that creation took place in a series of 6 days, which were the same as the days of 24 hours we now experience. Now, friends, that's pretty clear. And he doesn't really believe the truth, but he believes in exegesis. And he can say that. So the question is, why do new evangelicals want to take that? I think they want to cozy up with our modern interpretation of science. And there's no reason to do that. Well, I then have the evaluation of the creation account. In every case, with the exception of day two, God says this is good, and at the end he says it's very good. It does seem to me that the divine evaluation is that there's nothing negative at this point. It's positive. It's the created order is reflecting God's glory in a creaturely way. So the evaluation is very solid. Let me make 4 quick observations here, and then we'll conclude. I told your pastor I'd be done at 8. I'm a little bit after. So let me just wrap this up in about 2 minutes. First of all, God's created activities were supernatural. You were tracking with me in Genesis 1, and I think we could see that very clearly. That's one of the reasons to go through it very quickly. Also, God's creative activities were sudden. It wasn't slowly developing. The only way I think, if you have some type of evolutionary scheme, I can't conceive of it. To me, it's just, that's a greater leap of faith, except that's a Bartian leap of faith. There's no substance to it, but that's what we have to believe. So notice they were sudden. Also, God's activities were functionally mature. That's the necessity because it's designed to reproduce. So everything's mature that God creates that needs to reproduce. Notice there's aspects of a mature creation. Just think about this, but sometimes we just think it's the animals, the flowers, and that's true. But continents would have had some type of topsoil. You would have plants bearing seed. The text is very clear. Fruit trees bearing fruit. I think rocks with various isotopes. I don't see why that's a problem. Stars visible from the earth. Marine animals adapted to ocean life. Notice they were to swim in the sea. Birds able to fly. Land animals adapted to their environment. Plants and animals in symbiotic relationships. Adam and Eve as adults. That's part of what we're referring to as a mature creation. So put that into your theological minds and think about that. But I think there's some other things here that had to be part of that Motor creation. And then finally, God's activities reflect that He is the self-existent, eternal Creator God. We cannot have God creating Himself. That's logically an impossibility. Somebody had to be self-existent in order to have any type of created life. We have in theology what we call the creator-creation distinction. There are two realms. There's the realm of the creator, and there's the realm of the creation. Friends, we will never be in the realm of the creator because we'll never be the creator. But thank God, the creator has sought to save out and redeem people in that created order who will be joined to God's eternal life somehow to the Creator. And that is our hope, and that's what we look for. In fact, I'm looking for the day when God restores the created order, when we're perfect beings, when sin's been removed, when we do see that we go back to being vegetarians. Well, I'm not looking forward to that, but maybe you are. So, you know, we thank God for those things, and I probably need to dismiss you now. Now, if you would have any questions, we can coordinate with Pastor Postiff.
Well, if you have any questions, that's fine.
And by the way, if they're tough ones, I'm just going to throw the microphone back to him. So, now, did y'all have any questions? We might catch you off guard. If you want to think of it, if you don't have any tonight, then I'll try to take some tomorrow night. So, are there any questions? Well, that puts you on the spot, but if you think of it, write it down and then bring it back. I'll try to answer that, and I usually try to be diplomatic. Just be diplomatic with me. We're fellow believers. I treat you as a person in the image of God, and just treat me as the person in the image of God. Don't treat me like I'm just after my kind, like the animals. We treat each other as fellow image bearers. Okay, we'll write that down, and then we can get it tomorrow night. Dr. Postiff?